Good afternoon. It is so good to be with you. I want to invite you to not be distracted in about 8 minutes if some of my 4 o'clock church history students wander into the room. Hopefully they'll go over that way on the floor and won't distract. This is tough to read a paper after you hear a sermon and after your soul is convicted, but we will do what we've been assigned to do. A distracted piety, African-American Baptist. And let me say up front that this is not a distant paper. I grew up in what I now consider historically to be a distracted church, under a distracted preacher with some good loving, good natured folks who loved Christ but were distracted. And so this very much reaches home. And I initially did dove into this research really seeking to find just the opposite of what I found. And so it was quite a journey to go through that process of not wanting to believe something that's just so clear once you just kind of sit into some of the sources. A distracted piety, African-American Baptist. colored Baptists began to shape their own identities during the second half of the 19th century. Prior to this, they were generally, with few exceptions, nominally treated members of the larger white-controlled Baptist community in the United States. And along that line, there were three kind of main categories. Your balcony Baptists, your balcony black Baptists, which were those who went to church with their slave masters and either sat in the balcony, which was reserved for slaves, or sat in some side parlor, which was reserved. Your plantation Baptists, which would have been those who were gathered in slave churches on the plantation, and were often addressed by a missionary or addressed by the slave owner or addressed by an approved minister, maybe even the same minister at the church where the master attended. And this plantation Baptist was often reminded that the Bible said, slaves, obey your masters, and that was the preponderance of the gospel that they were often often heard. And then there was the invisible church, which would have been the church of slaves who snuck off for times of worship, often at night, often away in what are described as brush harbors, little areas down by waterways and other hidden areas that they might be away from their master. And often they had to go off great distances because this type of worship would entail Africanisms, meaning loud singing, ring dancing, and other such expressions that they were familiar with from Western African religious practices. So these types of expressions of black Christianity were prevalent in the antebellum era. However, after 1845, the division of America's Baptists over the issue of slavery and the 1863 signing of the Emancipation Proclamation by Abraham Lincoln, the prior arrangement was no longer acceptable to colored Baptists, particularly those in the South. For several decades, colored Baptists struggled to develop associations, institutions, and conventions to carry on their work. And this was extremely important to them because they wanted to prove two things. They wanted to prove their competence as individuals, and also they wanted to prove their usability by God. I am equally valid as a vessel in the hands of a mighty God. And so they were really driven through this, but in the midst of Reconstruction, in the midst of the transition right after the Emancipation Proclamation, it was really a struggle gathering together, developing associations, institutions, and conventions. Not until 1895 would they develop a national convention that represented the interests of most colored Baptists. And on September 28, 1895, there was a joint meeting in Atlanta with the Foreign Mission Baptist Convention, which had been established in 1880. the American National Baptist Convention, which had been established in 1886, and the National Baptist Educational Convention, which had been established in 1893, and these convened to become the National Baptist Convention of the United States of America, the first national body representing most colored Baptists in America. And these individual conventions would then become the foreign mission interest, the domestic mission interest, and the educational interest. 1 year before the founding of the National Baptist Convention of the United States of America, a new periodical appeared, the National Baptist Magazine, in 1894. It sought to represent the scholarship, opinions, and church business of colored Baptists nationwide. Using the early years of the National Baptist Magazine as a source, one can see that early colored National Baptist identity, while being unique due to the existential reality of racism, was doctrinally consistent with that of white Baptists as expressed in their generally accepted confessions of faith of that era. And I just note that this, I take the position that confessionalism is a characteristic of historic Baptist identity. And prior to 1894, the representative confessions would have been the Philadelphia Confession, the Articles of Faith of the Sandy Creek Association, the New Hampshire Confession, and other such local confessions. Humorous thing, the church I served, when I got there, I went through a study of their confession of faith, which happened to be the New Hampshire Confession of Faith. And interesting, in many of these older black Baptist sources, you just have the confession there, but there's no title to the confession. And unfortunately, it was quite disheartening to many of them once I told them that their grandmother didn't write that confession. And it was even more disheartening when I said a white person wrote that confession. But nonetheless, the New Hampshire Confession was the one of the generally accepted non-titled articles of faith in early black Baptist life. Using this National Baptist Magazine gives priority to this earliest of National Baptist literary sources as being representative of the purest notions of identity expressed by Negro Baptists on a national level during this formative period. I really want to emphasize that the 1890s and the turning over the 20th century is really the formative period for what you would, for a national organizational black Baptist identity. Colored Baptist identity was not shaped solely in the context of theological controversy. Racism was equally significant as a contextual factor. The importance of America's, quote, race problem cannot be overstated as a definitive component. David W. Wills has argued that race, he describes as the encounter of black and white, has been one of the three central themes in American religious history. His other two just happen to be pluralism and Puritanism. And he associates, of course, Puritanism with New England. And he associates pluralism with the middle colonies. And he associates the racial issue with the southern colonies. If race is such a significant part of the meta-narrative of American Christianity, certainly the Baptists in America did not escape its defining influence. Yet despite the potentially overwhelming presence of racism, early colored Baptists nonetheless carved out an identity that was distinctively Baptist as compared to colored Methodists, Presbyterians, other Protestants, and Roman Catholics. I want to seek to identify the theological continuity between black and white Baptists without discounting the social continuity. However, if the term Baptist is used to signify a theological and doctrinal designation rather than merely a social grouping, early colored Baptist identity mostly paralleled that of white Baptists. In Gayrard Wilmore's Black Religion and Black Radicalism and James Melvin Washington's Frustrated Fellowship, The Black Quest for Social Power, the religious identity of colored people, Baptists in particular, is often described in the context of radicalism, a term associated with the black religious nationalism and black power. This approach, without a consideration of black Baptists' doctrinal distinctives, has the potential to lead to a contrived identity for black Baptists that has no connection to the Baptist heritage that originated in 17th century Europe. This historiographical Ah, doctrinalism characterizes a phenomenological approach to religious studies and tends to undervalue the theological commitments and the doctrinal commitments of religious persons. Articles and sermons in the National Baptist Magazine reveal theological commitments that were not merely incidental to Baptist identity, but central. It should be conceded that the radicalism approach to African-American religious history rightly notes the outrage persons of color felt as they endured the scourges of racism, both from Christians and non-Christians. However, the Negro has often been sophisticated enough and endowed with enough discernment to distinguish, as Frederick Douglass said, between, quote, the Christianity of Christ and, quote, the Christianity of the slaveholder or the segregationist. Early issues of the magazine reveal no resolve among colored Baptists to jettison any part of the Christian tradition. This is a great contrast. And as a preacher, it's hard to just read the script. But this will be a great contrast between early black Baptists and radical black Christians, Baptists in particular, that you will see in the later part, in the middle part of the 20th century. There is no desire to jettison any part of the Christian tradition, nor to minimize essential Christian truths, the virgin birth, the resurrection of Christ, the deity of Christ. Rather, these Baptists were hopeful that a full embrace of Christianity and its radical social implications would lead to a better Baptist denomination and a brighter America. The early contributors to the magazine did not hesitate to critique white Baptists, other Christians, and America in general. However, the ethics of those being critiqued were always compared to what should be the ethic of authentic Christianity. The failure to make such a distinction presents the colored Christian as expressing an inadequate and inauthentic Christianity, such as when Wilmore said, quote, Christianity alone, unadulterated, otherworldly, and disengaged from this authentic implications, as it was usually presented to the slaves, could not have provided the slaves with all the resources they needed for the kind of resistance they expressed. It had to be enriched with the volatile ingredients of the African religious past, and most of all, with the human yearnings for freedom that found channel for expression in the early black churches of the South. In the above quote, it is unclear whether the Christianity was inadequate and in need of fixing, or whether it was something other than Christianity altogether. The outrage of these oppressed Christians is rightly expressed. However, the specific target of their outrage should be clearer. Often historical Christianity is attacked in African-American religious scholarship rather than the proponents of a bad hermeneutic. And it shows itself too often in the scholarship. The radicalism approach also often chooses definitive characters from among those having political significance rather than ecclesiological importance. In African-American history, just because someone is well known to be a black Baptist does not mean that they have significant role in shaping black Baptist identity. The most well-known white Baptist, probably ever, is Billy Graham. But one would not argue that Billy Graham has been a significant shaper of Baptist identity. For example, Wilmore cites Nat Turner, the 19th century leader of a slave rebellion, as a prototype Baptist. As Baptists are congregational and the pastor is prominent among the people, it seems more helpful to appeal to pastors and denominational leaders as definitive figures rather than political figures. The leaders who led colored Baptists after Reconstruction were pivotal in establishing identity for colored Baptists within the broader Baptist denomination. Early colored Baptists made a perspectival contribution to the Baptist heritage, but so did non-colored Baptists. Of course, the National Baptist Magazine featured articles addressing race and racial progress, as well as sermons and editorials calling for the development of one national convention. The humanity of the Negro was defended, both domestically and globally. However, I want to focus on the elements in the magazine that address and seek to clarify Baptist distinctives. What is impressive in the early years of the magazine is the editor's ability to maintain a reasonable balance between articles addressing issues of theology and those addressing issues of race. Unfortunately, as the years progressed, the articles in the magazine became less theologically definitive and more focused on the issue of race. Thus my use of the term distracted. Perhaps as time passed, a clear understanding of Baptist identity was assumed among colored Baptists. However, a more likely explanation is that responses to America's social sickness, racism, simply truncated theological discussion in the pages of the first national colored Baptist publication. One of the dangers of subsequent generations is assuming the orthodoxy that was so prevalent in a prior generation. And often in the modernist fundamentalist controversy at the turn of the 20th century, and then in the Southern Baptist Convention and the discussions over the authority of Scripture within the last 25 to 30 years, you can readily find African-American Baptists who will step back from the discussions and say, that's their fight, referring to white Baptists, that's their fight, not our fight. Assuming commitments to authority of Scripture, assuming commitments to essential Christian orthodoxy. Why is that assumption made? Because there are no outright statements to jettison authoritative Christian teaching, orthodox Christian teaching, but at the same time, with a truncated focus upon race, authoritative orthodox Christian teaching is not being constantly shared. And so it's a great assumption to assume that that is the generally held position of the believers in the gathered congregation. The inaugural issue of the National Baptist Magazine was published in January 1894. Its editor was W. Bishop Johnson. I've been trying to act like my eyes are not getting weaker, so I guess I'm just going to go ahead and lift this paper up. The inaugural issue of the National Baptist Magazine was published in January 1894. The editor was W. Bishop Johnson, pastor of the Second Baptist Church in Washington, D.C. It was governed by a publishing committee that included Reverend E.C. Morris, who would become the first president of the National Baptist Convention, a position that he held for 27 years. The magazine featured four sections, essays and articles called the review section, poetry, a sermonic section, and finally an editorial section. The original idea for a national magazine for colored Baptists was originally put forth by William James Simmons, a very influential colored preacher from Kentucky, of whom Simmons Bible College here in Louisville is named after, and Simmons University. The opening pages of this new magazine immediately attacked the practice of lynching based upon an exposition of the rape of Dinah in Genesis 34. The next essay, The Elevating Tendency of Religion, rejected pluralism and affirmed the uniqueness of Christianity. These two articles clearly demonstrated a desire to inform a readership that was specifically Christian, even as they experienced the perils of racism in America that was common to all colored people, regardless of their religious creed. Colored Baptist identity was no mere religious discussion. It had sociological and political implications. E.C. Morris said, quote, said in the demand for a Baptist publishing house that, quote, colored Baptists represent about 5/8 of the entire colored population in the United States. More accurately, that would have been in the South, but of course, from his perspective in the South, the United States, but that would have been a more accurate number for the South. With such numerical strength, one wonders how much of the moral and ethical worldview of Negroes at the turn of the century was influenced by Baptists. Also, colored Baptists were leading citizens, as Morris noted that colored Baptists did not have educational disparities when compared to colored Methodists or Presbyterians. This could not be said about white Baptists when they were compared with white Presbyterians or Episcopalians. Colored Baptists' numerical strength was not the result of mere racial solidarity, but was attributed to, quote, the simplicity of our Baptist polity and the correctness of our doctrine. Colored Baptists did see themselves as having a distinct identity as Baptists. Yet their distinct Baptist identity was existentially colored by their experience in America. Colored Baptists had never been allowed by white Baptists to forget that they were colored. Therefore, when the opportunity for independence came, they quickly left their white brethren and organized their own congregations. David O. Moore said, quote, "Within 4 years of the Emancipation Proclamation, the vast number of blacks who had come to be so large a part of white Baptist churches in the South had departed to form their own churches." Particularly in Virginia and South Carolina, some white Baptist churches had a majority population that was black. Moore further noted that departing Baptists never felt like, quote, "equal brothers in the flesh, nor equal under God." Emmanuel McCall described this phenomenon as the, quote, "inability of white churches and denominations to relate to black experiences with integrity," end quote. Thus, social circumstances in Baptist life in the South provided the impetus for the development of a unique colored Baptist existence and identity. Not theology, not doctrine, social circumstances. Had racism not been condoned and in some instances practiced by white Baptists, the impetus for separate colored institutions would not have existed. White and colored Baptists experienced two different realities in America. Therefore, the fact that they shared the same biblical understandings of doctrine and ecclesiology could not overcome the fact that they were as different as they were alike. For example, their evangelistic motives were sometimes different. James Melvin Washington has suggested, quote, "increasing discrimination against blacks in areas such as education, public accommodations, and jobs mandated a broadening of the preacher's understanding of evangelism." A very problematic, but nonetheless right there statement. An evangelism or a gospel that did not or would not address these injustices was seen as inadequate by many. This was particularly true of those colored Baptists that still maintain a holistic African approach to religion. This holistic African approach to religion, which allowed no convenient distinction between the religious and the political or the social. The most unique characteristic of this colorized Baptist identity, when compared with white Baptists in general, was its hope for a better America. In 1894, decades after the Emancipation Proclamation and following the disappointments of Reconstruction, William Waring still possessed the hope that the hour is drawing near when the gospel will be driven from its ranks, race hate, race pride, and a caste of every kind, and become in practice as well as theory the gospel of brotherly love. Specifically, an article entitled, quote, "The Negro Preacher of the 20th Century," suggested that the Negro Baptist preacher had a unique, comprehensive understanding of the gospel that had escaped his white European Baptist colleagues, who could not comprehend the desolation of a gospel without brotherly love. Focusing on the civil rights era of Southern history, Andrew Mannis highlighted these differing black and white civil religions as he described them. Mannis's categories are helpful as one considers the interactions between black and white Christians, particularly Baptists in the South, throughout American history. Lewis Baldwin's summary of Mannis's point is just as applicable to the 1890s as it was to the 1950s. Quote, "Mannis challenges the notion that black and white Southerners share a single, clearly defined version of civil religion. In other words, the black South's version of civil religion, which embraces universal rights, human equality, and interracial community under God, conflicts with that of the white South, which sanctions individual rights, white supremacy, and segregation on biblical and theological grounds." These early colored Baptists viewed themselves as having a Baptist identity that was to serve a broader Christian function in American society as they waited in prophetic anticipation for the unfulfilled racial agenda of justice for the Negro. The prophecy that, quote, "the white man of 100 years hence would repent of his unfulfilling of the gospel of love" came to pass in 1995 when the Southern Baptist Convention adopted a resolution on race that included a repudiation of its historical dealings with colored persons in America. This prophetic element of colored Baptist identity was vital, and those lacking some type of race consciousness were subject to severe criticism. One of the pressures that led to this distraction is because whether one was a Christian or not a Christian, a leader, and the black preacher was a leader in the black community, had to be seen as a race man, meaning one who was out for the betterment of the race. And any perceived equivocation on that was costly in credibility. The Negro preacher of that day, this is looking forward to the 20th century in 1894. The Negro preacher of that day will of necessity represent the religious thought of his people, and the preacher who comes among them with the claim that he is nothing more than a Methodist, a Baptist, an Episcopalian, or a Presbyterian will be sent to minister unto those who, like himself, are 100 years behind the age. Hindrances to baptism was a sermon delivered by William Credit, pastor of the Berean Baptist Church of Washington, D.C. Sermons are useful in discerning colored Baptist identity because significant parts of the Negro population were illiterate, and therefore oral discourse was their main epistemological mechanism, and thus also is one of the main frustrations for those seeking to do historical reflection. We are at a crucial age right now, a crucial time, because I'm always trying to meet older black ministers, older black Baptist religious leaders to talk about their lives over the last 70 to 80 years, and also to talk about what they remember of their parents' lives into the earliest 20th century and going back, because so much was not written. Hindrances to baptism, the sermon drew five principles from the story of the Ethiopian eunuch in Acts 8. The sermon could not have been more Baptist as it read, quote, "The great prerequisite to proper baptism is personal belief. Personal belief must precede baptism. And for Credit, this is the definitive element of Baptist identity. For he said, quote, "Upon this principle, the Baptist church takes its stand. This doctrine was no contrived notion, but merely a result of Baptist belief in a, quote, open Bible without word or comment. Therefore, when colored Baptists excluded Presbyterians from the Lord's Supper, they were not, in their eyes, practicing close communion, but rather close baptism that recognized nothing but believers' baptism and immersion as its proper mode. These early colored Baptists' distinctive beliefs and practices were consistent with that of their white brethren. For example, the principles of faith of the Sandy Creek Association stated, quote, that true believers are the only fit subjects of baptism and that immersion is the only mode, that the church has no right to admit any but regular baptized members to a communion at the Lord's table, end quote. The managing editor's first editorial clearly stated his desire that the magazine communicate the distinctives of colored Baptists. W. Bishop Johnson wanted colored Baptists to set forth their distinctive principles and boldly stand upon those principles and practices which differentiate Baptists from all the world and which have made them the, quote, sect everywhere spoken against. So they were willing to bear the humility of being Baptist. They were willing to bear the stains and the opposition for being Baptist. For Johnson, Baptist identity was something worth contending for. He said, quote, "We shall also be firm in placing the denominational tenets squarely before the world, aiming first, last, and at all times to stimulate pride in our doctrines by intelligent discussions and charitable controversy," end quote. It is significant that this inaugural editorial set forth an affirmation of Baptist identity in general rather than any specific contrived Negro Baptist doctrine. He further said, "We believe in Baptist principles not from necessity, nor force of association, nor family connections, but absolutely and unqualified from conviction." Hey, that's better than some people today say, "I'm Baptist because I was born Baptist." This also was an important statement as they staked out their racial independence organizationally, yet freely and willingly maintained theological principles with their white Baptist brethren. And by the way, they were really open. Many were open also to maintaining ministerial cooperation with their white Baptist brethren. Finally, it was the editor's opinion that publishing was a necessary tool for disseminating Baptist distinctions, second only to the pulpit. The second issue of the magazine, April 1894, contained a doctrinal article affirming the humanity of Jesus Christ, an appeal for churches to support the work of the Sunday school, and a sermon affirming the need of vital religion, a valid regeneration-based faith in Christ. These writings placed colored Baptists doctrinally within the broad Baptist family. An article by William Phillips, pastor of Shiloh Baptist Church in Philadelphia, declared a Baptist distinction with his title, Alien Immersion Not Valid in a Baptist Church. Since those attempting to come into Baptist congregations from non-Baptist churches were the issue, Phillips began by discussing who was a, quote, proper administrator of baptism. Basically, the administrator must have been truly regenerate. He must have been immersed, and they have that in emphasis. He must have been immersed and held church membership in some other Baptist church, and he must have been ordained. All others were improper administrators. Therefore, those coming from Methodist, Presbyterian, or other tradition lacking a proper administrator were not recognized as being baptized. In declaring those so-called baptisms invalid, this colored Baptist invoked the regulative principle when he wrote, quote, he, the one seeking to enter the Baptist congregation, does not believe in the scriptures as being the only authority for his conduct and practice in this matter as we do. These early colored Baptists were aware of the need to actively maintain a clear understanding of Baptist distinctives. In a prophetic warning about the loss of Baptist identity that would be borne out in the 20th century by white Baptists in the South and the North, Phillips warns, quote, there is at this present day a strong desire for popular praise and applause, which is likely to pull our old Baptist ship loose from her moorings and set her afloat upon the high seas of irregularity with the danger of foundering upon the rocks of skepticism and unfaithfulness. The lead article in the July 1894 issue of the magazine called for Baptists to pursue education with an eye towards influencing society. This call for more Baptist intellectuals was careful to avoid sanctioning rationalism. The role of education in the shaping of culture was noted in the belief that Christian education is the salt of civilization, the bulwark of human governments and institutions. Another article fully supported the exercise of church discipline. R.H. Porter, pastor of the Third Baptist Church of Alexandria, Virginia, contributed the longest article in this issue entitled Why I Am a Baptist, Bible Reasons for Our Faith. After investigating the principles that Baptists regard as important and vital, he adopted an article by a Dr. MacArthur of New York. There was no indication as to MacArthur's race. The article listed six basic principles of Baptist life. 1, regenerate church membership. 2, belief precedes baptism, which precedes the Lord's Supper. 3, baptism is not necessary to salvation, but should be done unless one is physically unable. 4, religious freedom, the tenet that the civil magistrate has no authority over a man's religious creed and usage. 5, immersion is essential to baptism. Therefore, immersion is prerequisite for the Lord's Supper. 6, faith must be personal, and no man can believe for another. This article reflected an understanding of colored Baptist identity that is doctrinal and biblical, being ordered by the New Testament. Although the article was adopted from another author, it is significant that such a doctrinal exposition of Baptist identity was the centerpiece article in that issue. Pardon me. These Baptists thought critically about Baptist distinctives and the nature of American Christianity in general. An insightful article by M.W. Gilbert, president of Florida Baptist Academy, evaluated colored churches, especially those that were Baptist. The article, Colored Churches, an Experiment, evaluated certain elements of Baptist identity as were, I'm sorry, I skipped my sentence. In colored church and experience, certain elements of Baptist identity were seen as being abused by some congregations of newly freed Negroes. While appreciating the, quote, free congregations that no longer were subject to the supervision and surveillance of the whites, Gilbert critiqued some of the attributes of the churches that had developed since the Emancipation Proclamation. Highlighting some of the faults observable in our colored churches, Gilbert first chided colored Baptists for rarely resorting to the use of associational counsel. In an excessive and abusive understanding of local church autonomy, these new free churches were too free as they neglected, quote, the usage of consulting a council of sister churches for advice. This is a helpful illustration of the challenges these new congregations faced as they came out from under white Baptist supervision and association. Further, the churches were chided for seeking counsel from ungodly ministers. In memorable rhetoric, Gilbert said some of the so-called councils were composed of ministers that were, quote, too rascally and unscrupulous to sit in a council of demons. The author sought a reasonable balance between autonomy, associationalism, and accountability. He pointed out, quote, in too many instances, since our emancipation, we have taken liberty to mean license and freedom to do right as freedom to do as we please. This was not a retreat from the Baptist distinctive of local church autonomy, just a rebuke of its excesses. Holding up an effective model, Gilbert said, quote, among the white people, autonomy is a thing of beauty and a joy forever. And I just noted that Gilbert, of course, did not foresee what white Baptists would do with autonomy in the 20th century. But at that particular moment, the interaction, the associationalism was seen as a beauty and a joy forever. Actually, local autonomy was cast as favorable for the Negro's future rather than other forms of polity that were characterized as being oppressive. Mingling polity and race, he contrasted colored Methodists and Baptists. Quote, it is oftentimes supposed that the apparent peace and quiet observed among the colored Methodists argue a better form of church government for colored people than that existing among colored Baptists. But that which at first seems to be a reflection upon our denomination is at once to our credit. The Methodist's polity and that of all Episcopal bodies is better adopted to secure the harmony and strength of the individual church for the present. But because the Negroes are accustomed to having a master, a driver, or someone to dictate to him and to do his thinking for him, the future is more favorable to the Baptist when in this free republic with slavery unfelt and forgotten, the Negro will really, in reality, be free. Besides autonomy, colored churches were critiqued for having, quote, the demagogue or politician in the pulpit, toleration of bad men in the ministry, power-hungry ministers, hasty and inconsiderate ordinations, too many church splits, and the multiplication of feeble churches that cannot support a full-time pastor. The article leveled a particularly stinging rebuke at excessive building debt and its detrimental effect on missions. Here's a good word from a 19th century Negro Baptist for 2009 Baptist. Quote, a poor people almost baptized in the pauperism vying with the wealthy white man, free for centuries in building meeting houses, the craze for fine meeting houses is upon us. State missions, home missions, education must go to the dogs for the present. Africa and lost souls must wait 15 or 20 years until the debt is paid and the mortgage removed. Sacramentalism among colored churches is also pointed out as churches erroneously serve the Lord's Supper to individuals when it is a church ordinance. Additionally, I'm not sure I fleshed that out clearly. You're speaking of individual appointments of the Lord's Supper or Lord's Supper in other places other than the gathered meeting of the congregation. Additionally, the, quote, blessing of infants by Baptists is criticized for being too akin to infant baptism as well as a violation of the regulative principle. Finally, the author was not too impressed with, quote, the excessive emotionalism in our preaching and worship, end quote. This extensive critique, which ran over two consecutive issues, reveals the importance of polity, ecclesiology, ordinances, holiness, and ministerial qualification to leading early colored Baptists. In addition to continuing the article, critiquing colored churches, the October 1894 issue sought to advance the cause of equality by examining the common origin of humanity, advocating the study of Baptist history, and passed a resolution on lynching, which noted the significant efforts of Ida B. Wells. In a brief reference to a soteriological matter, one columnist suggested predestination and election grow out of God's knowledge as to how men would exercise their free agency. So those types of issues were also being considered. Although freedmen were anxious to pursue the independent development of various Baptist institutions and organizations, they had no desire to disassociate with their white brethren. When a colored preacher, T.D. Miller, was elected moderator of America's oldest Baptist association, the magazine rejoiced, quote, "The Philadelphia Association has not only honored Dr. Miller, but the entire Negro race." Finally, the magazine reported on the beginning efforts to unify in one national organization the work of colored Baptists that was now being carried out by at least three significant and separate conventions. The Foreign Mission Convention, 1880, sponsored missions work to Africa. The National Baptist Convention, 1886, examined questions affecting race and denomination and published the National Baptist Magazine. The National Baptist Educational Convention, 1893, encouraged education, religious and non-religious, among colored Baptists. The article distinguished between the conventions and the denomination. Despite their organizational boundaries, these were all Baptists, and they knew it. Anticipating the events of the following year, the article noted, quote, "An effort is now being made to amalgamate the three organizations into one grand body." Thus, the magazine's first year featured clear understandings of Baptist identity, reasoned outrage over the injustices of racism, self-critical evaluations of colored Baptists, and a call for national solidarity among colored Baptists. Subsequent years of the magazine reflected broader involvement in social concerns, and unfortunately, theological issues began to be eclipsed. February 20th, 1895, marked the death of Frederick Douglass. This event overshadowed much in black life that year. Reflecting Douglass's prominence, the vast majority of the magazine during the second and third quarters paid tribute to Douglass. Not discounting the significance of Frederick Douglass in African-American history, but obviously if two issues of a quarterly magazine are paying tribute to Frederick Douglass, then that's two issues that are not addressing the issues of Baptist identity that were previously being addressed the year before. There were pictures, articles, poems, and a variety of memorials in its pages. The magazine even attempted to raise funds by selling pictures of the famous American. Told you they were Baptists. Despite Douglass's Methodism, he was honored and revered for an extended period of time in the National Baptist Magazine. Concern for Africa by these colored Baptists led to constant appeals in the magazine for mission support. The missiological thrust of early colored Baptists is a stark contrast to the efforts of some black Baptist denominations today. Future president of the Combined Convention, E.C. Morris, made a stirring appeal in the July 1895 issue. Missions appeals were frequently made appealing to the reader's concerns for the unbelieving soul. Alexander Moore, pastor of the Antioch Baptist Church of Cleveland, Ohio, appealed, "Brethren, if we are ever to make a success of our convention or our denominational work, we must lay aside our selfishness and work from love to God and to poor, suffering humanity. Think of the millions of precious souls who, without God and without hope, are rapidly passing into a long, long eternity, while some of us, under the pretense of helping them, are only seeking the gratification of some selfish desire. In order to pursue missions in a coordinated manner, colored Baptists needed a more efficient denominational structure. By 1897, after 2 years of the national organization, it was apparent that annual meetings were cumbersome venues to organize year-long missionary efforts. Without any model present from their white brethren, this was before the Southern Baptist Convention's establishment of its executive committee, it was apparent that someone or somebody needed to be able to run the convention when it was not an annual session. Moore suggested that colored Baptists needed a permanent headquarters and salaried officers who could give their entire time and attention to the management of different departments. These early Baptists had no desire to organize nationally for sentimental purposes. They were called upon to organize efficiently in order to do the work of God as equal participants in Christian missions with their white brethren. Part of the equal participation involved being able to set missions priorities. Africa was the primary concern of colored missions-minded Baptists. Their understanding of theodicy meant God had allowed them to be brought to America as slaves for some redemptive purpose. Even as white racism was criticized, it was noted that, quote, the evils of slavery were turned to gracious account, and in return, placing the Negro Christian of this great country under lasting obligation to work for African evangelization. Amazing how people, a generation from slavery and Reconstruction, often had more God-honoring theology and consideration than their followers today who have so much more in educational privilege. Washington further noted that black Baptists doubted whether white Baptists were, quote, seriously interested in evangelizing Africa. A subtle shift in emphasis took place in the magazine as the sermon section began to be irregular, and finally full sermons were replaced by mere sermon quotes in a section called Sparks from the Anvils of Afro-American Pulpits as the new century loomed on the horizon. Wow, full sermons down to mere quotes. Presidential addresses of the convention began to be printed in the magazine. These addresses often covered a wide array of topics. More than communicating the distinctives of Baptist identity to the faithful, these addresses usually surveyed the political, social, and cultural settings that were currently challenging colored Baptists. The addresses usually bore the weight of the Negro's unfulfilled citizenship in America. The 1899 issue of the magazine carried E.C. Morris's presidential address entitled "The Church as a Factor in Solving the Race Problem in America." He expressed regret that, quote, many of the churches of our country have remained silent while the very foundational principles of our great country are being undermined. For him, the church was not being faithful to the principles of equality as expressed in America's civil religion, which were recorded in the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution. However, he must have recognized the limitations of civil religion, for he noted when the Bible has been made the Alpha and Omega of our country, there will be no race problem to solve. Despite Morris's appeals to civil religion and his description of America as a Christian nation, the essentiality of God's church was understood when he said, quote, no legislative enactments backed by a million armed men
can force recognition of the Negro's rights in this country until a moral sentiment has been created among the people to grant those rights. And that sentiment can only be created through and by the Church of God, which is the true exponent of all moral law. As the content of the National Baptist Magazine became more diverse, addressing the problems of race, as well as reporting on denominational agencies, specific articles delineating Baptist distinctives did not appear as in the magazine's first 2 years. However, colored Baptists were still able to somewhat condemn for Baptist identity within the broader Baptist family as they sought peaceful recognition from their white brethren. Apparently, as colored Baptists began to seek to organize after Reconstruction, some whites were either threatened or offended by such activity. In his 1899 presidential address, E.C. Morris assured his listeners that colored Baptists were a legitimate, quote, wing of our great and invincible denomination. Despite the racism, insensitivity, and paternalism that characterized the experience of black Christians and white-led churches, Morris declared that the National Baptist Convention bore no race hatred towards white Christians. Seeking to clarify misunderstandings about the convention's purpose, he said, quote, I wish to repeat what I have said on several occasions, that this society entertains no ill will towards any other Christian organization in the world. It seeks to be on friendly terms with all, and the charge that this organization means to draw the color line and thereby create prejudice in Negro Christians against white Christians is without foundation. 1899. White Baptists were encouraged to learn from black Baptists who sought to obliterate all sectional lines among Baptists and to establish a truly national organization. White opposition was a serious obstacle to be overcome. James Washington captured the fear, necessity, and tension of the moment when he said, quote, many believed that a greater sense of racial solidarity was a prerequisite to forming a strong racial ecclesiastical bond. But they really did not know how to create a greater sense of racial loyalty in a society that frowned upon black solidarity and among white denominational brethren who had a history of working against such unions. Opposition to colored denominational unity came on two fronts. First, hostile opposition sought to disrupt planning meetings and annual sessions of black Baptist organizations. One notable example was the attack on Emmanuel Love, pastor of the African Baptist Church of Savannah, Georgia, as he traveled to Indianapolis on the East Tennessee, Virginia, and Georgia railroads. Secondly, friendly opposition came from paternalistic white brethren as blacks rejected invitations to join northern organizations that did, quote, home missions work in the South. Despite such oppositions, colored Baptists pushed forward and established a national organization and institutions that distinctly colored Baptists in their doctrine and experientially colored in their survey. I'm sorry, let me read this sentence again, please. Despite such opposition, colored Baptists pushed forward and established a national organization and institutions that were distinctively Baptist in their doctrine and experientially colored in their social and ethical outlook. A survey of the early issues of the National Baptist Magazine revealed a colored Baptist identity that was uniquely colored while intentionally desiring to be consistently Baptist. The early writings expressed outrage over racial injustice in America, but maintained a balanced presentation of Baptist doctrinal distinctions. As it regarded issues of polity, immersion, the Lord's Supper, church membership, the regulative principle, associationalism, and a host of other issues and missions, colored and white Baptists believed the same thing and shared a common identity. However, the prominent issue of race, a pivotal marker in American religious history, forced colored Baptists to, quote, come out from among them who were mostly just like them and be separate. If the early, and I need to summarize this last section because I want to have time for some questions. If early organizational black Baptist piety was distracted by the essential necessity, by the existential necessity of the struggle for freedom following slavery and Reconstruction, at the turn of the 20th century, then the mid-century civil rights movement was likewise another necessary distraction. I want to draw some parallels between the late 19th century and the middle of the 20th century. However, this latter distraction was more enduring and substantial because of the personality of Martin Luther King Jr. King was a distraction to Black Baptist piety in at least three ways. One, his call to ministry. Two, who he thought was an ideal preacher. And three, his rejection of his daddy's faith. And let me emphasize that I'm not addressing King as a civil rights leader or a significant American. I'm not addressing his personal convictions regarding Christianity. I'm addressing his significant effect or impact, I should say, on Black Baptist identity. His call to ministry, his ideal preacher, and his rejection of his daddy's faith. In his 1948 application for admission to Crozer Theological Seminary, King was asked to describe his personal reasons for wanting to, quote, study for the gospel ministry. His answer is incredibly void of any reference to the gospel. Let me quote it here. Quote, my call to the ministry was quite different from most explanations I've heard. This decision came about in the summer of 1944 when I felt an inescapable urge to serve society. In short, I felt a sense of responsibility which I could not escape. That could be the call to be the president of the Red Cross. That could be the call to be a Boy Scout leader. Unfortunately, this type of calling would be repeated by a generation of socially concerned individuals who determined that they were destined to be reverends. King is a paradigm of a Black Baptist preacher and of a Black Baptist. And by him being a reverend, then a reverend is seen as being a great tool of social change in the community. Thus, you have significant and influential Black reverends who never preached the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ. So you have Reverend Al Sharpton, Reverend Jesse Jackson, Reverend Andrew Young, Reverend this person, Reverend this person. And you go through their history and you never find episodes of them preaching the gospel of the Lord Jesus Christ, but rather of them being agents of social change. Martin Luther King, that was the first point, his call to ministry. The second point was who he thought was his ideal preacher. Ah, this just makes me sick. Martin Luther King once described Harry Emerson Fosdick as, quote, the greatest preacher of the century. This admiration led King to appreciation of and appropriation of various hermeneutical and homiletical practices from Fosdick. At Crozer, he drank from Fosdick's 1942, The Modern Use of the Bible, and was commended by his professor because King had, quote, grasped the theological significance of biblical criticism. This would certainly bear fruit later as King served in a variety of denominational positions during his early years as a pastor. Daddy King had raised his son in what Martin called, quote, a rather strict fundamentalist tradition. The preacher's son would leave seminary, rejecting the tradition of his childhood. Initially attracted to liberalism, he found its doctrine of man inadequate in light of mankind's obvious bent towards sin. However, an indelible imprint was made on King's thinking by Walter Rauschenbusch's Christianity and the Social Crisis. Once his approach to the gospel was realigned, he studied social ethics. He studied social and ethical theory. A methodology was discovered in the life and teachings of Mahatma Gandhi, thus providing King with a peculiar approach as a civil rights advocate. Incidentally, as it regards Black Baptist piety, King also happened to be the best known Black Baptist in the world. It is certainly noteworthy that many things have distracted Black Baptist piety. Black Baptists at the turn of the 20th century, Black Baptists in the throes of the civil rights movement. influenced at the turn of the century by the writers of their national magazine, who became distracted in their writing by the pressing issues of race, and influenced by the prominence of Martin Luther King Jr., ascribed to him by the churches, ascribed to him by the media, and by his own personal abilities to attract followers. The Black Baptist identity that started out paralleling that of white Baptists has perilously been eclipsed by the pressures and the existential angst of racism. Now, let me just say that it's also noteworthy that Black Baptist piety has not merely been affected by the major distraction of race, but rather by multiple distractions. And I didn't have time to go into them, but, you know, there's no theology. There's liberation theology. There's a health, wealth, and prosperity gospel. There's the social gospel. And let me just say finally, the term distraction is used to convey a lack of intentionality. The distracted influencer of Black Baptist identity is different than the white Baptist, liberal Baptist that deliberately wants to jettison essential Christian truths or white Christian in general. Thus, I can say, for example, that Harry Emerson Fosdick, Norman Vincent Peale, and Martin Luther King had terrible effects on the pulpit in America in the 20th century. But I can say at the same time that King was distracted and Fosdick and Peale were deliberate. I'm a gospel preacher, so I need some hope. There are hopeful signs of clarifying elements in Black Baptist life. The influence of Pentecostalism, the greater educational opportunities for younger pastors, and a generational shift from the Martin Luther King paradigm, young Black reform educated pastors, and the steady, if often minority, voice of plain, simple gospel preachers.